Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Thursday, June 11th, reality shows Cops and Live PD have been canceled amid worldwide protests against racial injustice. We're talking about how maybe they're part of the reason why we're here. Also, Georgia is once again grappling with major problems at the polls. We get a sense of what the community is thinking.
Something Stacey Abrams raised in 2018 is perhaps some of these technicalities were used to disenfranchise groups of voters in a way that is politically expedient for certain folks in power.
And how's your voting going?
2 hours standing outside in the hot sun, another 2 hours inside.
There was no line at my location.
Uncomfortably hot, lightheaded, and nauseous.
First up, we take a look at our own industry and what being, quote, objective really means in the news media landscape. A lot of the breaking news this week came from inside newsrooms around the country.
It is 5:54, and this morning, the editor-in-chief of Bon Appetit magazine has resigned amid questions about equality within the company.
The opinion editor of the New York Times has just resigned amid an uproar over an op-ed by Republican Senator Tom Cotton calling for military force potentially to be used against rioters in U.S. cities.
The top editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer is resigning days after the newspaper published a very controversial headline. Stan Wisnowski apologized for the, quote, "Buildings Matter Too" banner.
Top editors at a number of major outlets stepped down this week after black journalists and other journalists of color spoke out about the editorial processes and systemic racism many say they've experienced at work. Last Thursday, a group of journalists of color at the Philadelphia Inquirer called in sick to express their anger over the paper's repeated failures to listen to their concerns. In an open letter to the Inquirer's leadership, staff members wrote, quote, "We're tired of seeing our words and photos twisted to fit a narrative that does not reflect our reality. And we're tired of being told to show both sides of issues there are no two sides of." Meanwhile, other organizations have started taking clear stands when it comes to today's racial justice uprising. On Saturday, the owner of the Los Angeles Times referenced Black Lives Matter in a letter to readers, and the Washington, D.C. outlet Axios announced it would allow its reporters to join protests. Reporters of color have long disputed the notion of objectivity in journalism, arguing that the premise only reinforces a white majority point of view that has always dominated the industry. And this week, we saw signs that the people in power may finally be starting to listen. I have three people now with me to discuss all of this. Doris Truong is the Director of Training and Diversity at the Poynter Institute. Doris, hi.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Rochelle Riley is the Director of Arts and Culture for the City of Detroit and a former columnist for the Detroit Free Press. Rochelle, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Maya King is a 2020 reporting fellow at Politico. Maya, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Maya, let's start with you. We're seeing a lot of journalists, particularly black journalists, speaking out publicly against the current and former employers, including the New York Times. Tell us a little bit about what this moment, because we know that these are not new issues, but are we seeing change now because black journalists are saying they've had enough and they're willing to take action?
I think we are, Tanzina. And what I'm seeing more is that this is really a referendum on what objectivity is, which I think we can now agree it's kind of a myth. In all of the reporting decisions that black reporters make, from which voices that we elevate, which the order of the paragraphs that we write, the way that we even decide to attack a story and really report things out. I mean, these are all subjective decisions that we make. But when we start to have the conversation around what objectivity is, the definition is often very unfair to black journalists, especially when we're talking about our very real lived experiences that can sometimes be uncomfortable to really discuss in predominantly white spaces, which newsrooms more often than not really tend to be. And so what we're seeing now are private conversations about pay parity and unfair hiring practices, or even the way that we are edited that might be incorrect, you know, according to what we've actually seen and heard about these stories. Is now coming to the fore, and it's really a reckoning now, and it's forcing a number of white newsroom leaders to really listen and understand and make changes.
So I want to drill down on that point, because forcing white newsroom leaders to listen, I can speak from my own experience as well, is not an easy thing to do. Now, we are starting to see some action taken. Doris, I'd love your thoughts here, because we saw the resignation of top editors at the New York Times, like James Bennett, who was essentially in line to run the paper, and Stan Wisnowski at the Philadelphia Inquirer stepped down. Is that real accountability, Doris?
I think that what we need to see beyond these resignations is the people who are coming in after them, their replacements. What are they going to do to actually enforce change? Because we see these bold actions, but they don't necessarily mean that the person who's coming in afterward is going to bring in the positive change that journalists of color and our allies are hoping to see.
Rochelle, we mentioned at the very top that there was the LA Times, for example, issued an editorial citing, quoting Black Lives Matter and saying, quote, "We cannot be bystanders and enablers in a crisis. We must all work toward a peaceful solution so that all Americans can be truly equal under the law." That sounds great, Rochelle, but what does that really mean? I mean, what is it that newsrooms that are now citing Black Lives Matter trying to achieve here?
Well, it means absolutely nothing unless the leadership that wrote it begins to start hewing to that claim. I think what you're seeing is that George Floyd, in his death, has ripped sort of the veil away from all of these false constructs that journalists have had to live by for decades and decades. There has never been objectivity in journalism. What there's been is that false construct that made reporters, particularly Black reporters, hew to a certain narrative. And now there's more truth-telling, and there's a greater sense that some of the things that were acceptable in the past are no longer tolerated. But as Dora said, if you don't have new people to come in and change the traditional way of doing things, what you have is new people coming in and doing things the same way they've always been done.
One of the other things that we saw at the very top was that the news organization Axios, which is all about political news, recently announced that they would allow their reporters to participate in Black Lives Matter protests. Maya, your thoughts on that? Because I think a lot of newsrooms right now are sort of trying to figure out what they consider to be human rights efforts that reporters are allowed to show participation in versus political efforts, which traditionally we've never been allowed to do. So what do you think that means? And is it significant in your eyes?
I do believe it is significant. I believe it's a recognition of journalists who are also private citizens. And that's a really, it's a thin line to walk, but we're living in a moment that's more than just a political conversation. I think now we've entered more a moral conversation and what our duty is now just as citizens in this country to speak up. I mean, a number especially of Black journalists have been disproportionately impacted by all that we're seeing. The coronavirus disproportionately impacts African Americans. Obviously, we've witnessed on video and in the news several now African Americans who have been killed by police or by you know, neighborhood watchmen and things like that. I mean, these are really emotional and really important issues and topics. And it's unfortunate that our newsrooms are not, you know, diverse enough to really be able to report on this fully. But I think the decision that Axios made would probably encourage a number of reporters to say, look, this is actually a really important issue. And while I might not be covering it or living it, I'd like to take part and even learn, you know, exactly what's happening with my colleagues and with my fellow citizens. I think it was an important step forward. And it's, you know, a really important level of transparency for Axios to come out and say that. I think it applies pressure to a number of other newsrooms to make sweeping decisions like this and say, look, no, we support our reporters and we support those who have decided to make this decision and actually learn and take part in what's happening right outside their door.
Doris, when this has come up a lot right now, the notion of objectivity. And I often think about Christiane Amanpour, who has said a couple of times that she is truthful. She's not neutral. You have actually worked with PBS in terms of how they frame this issue of objectivity. Where does it stand at this point?
Yeah, I was brought in as a third-party journalist in 2017 and 2018 to work with the committee that was revising PBS's editorial standards and practices. And we actually did not have a protracted discussion about replacing the term objectivity in those standards with the fully fleshed out definitions of what fairness and accuracy are, which are things that we encourage PBS's journalists to strive for. And I think that that's really the heart of it, because objectivity in and of itself is a very subjective thing.
Rochelle, we're seeing, in addition to folks stepping down and people allowing for more conversation, at least about Black Lives Matter, there's also a conversation about the use of social media and how much journalists shouldn't. And this has been happening since Twitter started. I mean, at least for a decade, I recall meetings at the New York Times where journalists were being told what to do and what not to do. In this moment, how should news organizations deal with sensitivities of race and hashtags like Black Lives Matter and being able to speak out about things in general for social media?
Well, I can tell you that what they can't do is what Axios did. I think that things are a little different now with social media and the immediacy of being able to speak, but it is so important for journalism to get its game back and to build trust again. And you cannot report and talk to people about what they're yelling about if you're yelling at the top of your lungs. I thought that was a really grave mistake and a step back. I think when you're talking about social media where you're sharing the feelings of people, you're retweeting something that someone has said, that makes some sense. But if you're someone, for instance, who's covering a police department and you tweet that a police department is racist, that does not give you the room that you need to then talk about why there's racism, does it involve every police officer, and talking to people about what needs to be done. I think we have got to make sure we maintain that line between the profession and the honor that has always been associated with journalism and the free will of saying whatever you want and putting everything out whenever you want. There's got to be some sense of following some of those guidelines and forums that kept our ethics clean, that made people understand that we were somebody who was bringing them news instead of being the news. I don't think reporters can be the news and do their jobs.
Do you think that that's something that's generational, or is it something that you're seeing just applied to folks who are using social media in different ways? Because at this point, we're about 10 years into Twitter. Is it something that's generational among younger folks, perhaps?
I'm loath to always blame young folks in a big vacuum and in a big group. But I can tell you, as someone who has been on Twitter from the beginning, I have seen the shift from what it became in the beginning to now it being the actual billboard where everybody uses it to throw their stuff at it. And if you're going to be someone who's on Twitter and who's bringing the reputation of your craft and whoever you work for to the fore, you've got to make sure that people know the difference between you and between some guy who's sitting in his basement in Milwaukee just saying anything. There's a difference in what Yamiche Alcindor tweets. And she's always fair and always balanced, but sometimes makes very clear that something has been said that is silly. And somebody who literally calls someone silly. You cannot call Donald Trump names and call him president and be able to report on him fairly. We have got to make sure we uphold the standards that have always made journalism different from social commentary that is done by anyone. There's a certain training, there's a certain workmanship that goes into being a journalist. And again, you can't tell the story if you are the story. So I would just suggest that people can make sure they capture that passion and caption what people are saying without necessarily being too involved.
Doris, I want to ask you, you moderated a conversation this week with the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, including a number of prominent journalists of color, about how journalists of color can talk about these issues in their newsroom without getting fired, which is what a lot of folks, I think, are afraid of. whether they're blasting this on social media or talking about it behind the scenes. Do you have some top line takeaways from that conversation about how to have these conversations that are real, but also to Rochelle's point, not making yourself the story, which I think is hard for a lot of folks?
I think what we're seeing is that there's a lot of power in collective action. As we referenced at the top of this program, many staffers of the Philadelphia Inquirer shared their pain in that the Buildings Matter 2 headline was offensive to them, but also emblematic of decades of journalists of color feeling like they're doing more work. One of the issues with journalists of color is that it feels as though, for many of us, we're having to constantly apologize for what we're doing, for bringing our whole selves to the work. We're being held to a standard that our white colleagues aren't necessarily being held to. And many of those white colleagues are in positions of a power of authority over us. And so it's should not be our job to make sure that they feel good about what they're doing. They really need to interrogate what perspectives are missing in their own lives and how that might influence what ends up being shown or published for the audience.
Well, and I just want to expand on that a little bit before I get to Maya for another question here, Doris, is that when journalists of color do that, they often, particularly if they're women of color, often can be seen as agitators or as people who are, quote unquote, difficult in the newsroom, and they can hurt themselves by looking for future work.
Well, I would just say that this is a moment in which people who want to do that agitating should know that you're not alone. So even if you don't think that you have that support within your newsroom, there are lots of resources, including journalism associations, that were built for journalists of color to help you figure out how to navigate these conversations and to give you models where people have been more successful in inclusion and diversity.
Maya, we're talking right now about people in newsrooms, but there are, of course, lots of folks who were talking on Twitter yesterday and prior to this about the fact that they couldn't deal with the quote-unquote microaggressions and really the racism that many of them say they experienced forced them to leave the industry altogether. What do you think the industry needs to do to rethink how it retains, doesn't just hire, but how it retains and promotes talent of color?
Yeah, I think it really is a shame that, you know, we've lost so much good talent to just newsroom environments, and the fact that journalism remains a very white industry that can be very difficult to break into and stay in. I think one of the really important steps that we have to take is making sure that we have representation of people of color, that's Black, Latino, Asian, Native American people in senior level positions in these newsrooms. I think it's really, really important that those who are making editorial decisions reflect the makeup of this country. And not only putting them in those positions, but giving them the tools that they need to actually be successful. It's one thing, I think, to put a Black woman in a position of editor-in-chief or managing editor at any major publication. But if you haven't given her the support, if you haven't given her the training and the skill sets, I mean, what now are you looking at here? And making sure that, you know, anybody who is in these positions actually, you know, understands really what it means to diversify newsrooms and diversify coverage, who is able to really hold those tough conversations and make sure that they're including everyone in the newsroom in these conversations. I think, you know, when the coronavirus really hit, American newsrooms responded immediately. We were able to completely go offline. A lot of people changed beats. I don't think the transition was seamless, but it was very quick and very sophisticated. And so now we find ourselves in another crisis, and it's time for us to do the same thing and have different conversations. It's a tougher reckoning, but it's a necessary one.
Rochelle, we've got a minute left in the segment. Would love to end on your thoughts about how journalists of color who do get these positions can actually achieve the institutional support that Maya was referencing there.
Well, Maya is right. It doesn't matter if you hire someone if you don't listen to them, and you cannot get away with saying you can't find someone, because if you can't find them, you train them. And if you can't train them, then you don't need to be in the job. So I think the first thing we have to do is recognize that almost every newsroom can be better. And if you do want to cover your community, you have to have the firepower and the people in that newsroom who can do it.
Rochelle Riley is the Director of Arts and Culture for the City of Detroit and the author of The Burden, African Americans and the Enduring Impact of Slavery. Maya King is a 2020 reporting fellow at Politico. And Doris Truong is the Director of Training and Diversity at the Poynter Institute. Thanks to the three of you for a fantastic conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
I got my potato.
On Radiolab.
And I'm looking at it and I'm holding it.
We consider the mundane.
It's a handsome shape.
And stop to smell the potatoes.
I've been telling people about my potato. They're always surprised, and I say, you wouldn't understand.
Small potatoes on Radiolab.
It's my friend.
Listen wherever you get podcasts.
And now we turn to Georgia, where on Tuesday, voters spent hours waiting on long lines and dealing with equipment malfunctions and other indignities during the state's primary election. And many of the worst voting scenarios disproportionately took place in communities of color. Democrats and Republicans are blaming everything from new voting machines to the COVID-19 pandemic for the mess. But Georgia's voting problems didn't start this week. The state has a long history of voter suppression. And that could mean voters will have an even tougher time casting their ballots later this summer as the state prepares for runoff elections in August and the presidential election in November. Helping us break all of this down is Tia Mitchell, Washington correspondent with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Tia, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We saw essentially a mess across Georgia, but it was concentrated in specific communities. Tell us about that discrepancy.
Yes, so roughly 20 of 159 counties had issues, but the most pronounced issues, the longest lines, the longest waits, were in parts of Fulton and DeKalb County, and DeKalb is right next to Fulton County, so that's Metro Atlanta's core counties. And within those counties, which are their very large counties geographically, so those problems were mostly concentrated in parts of those counties that are populated heavily by African Americans. And so that has been one of the concerns raised, is that the problems did seem to be more heavily concentrated in African-American communities, although they were scattered throughout the state.
So let's talk a little bit about that, because when you see these types of issues concentrated in a certain area, we mentioned that both Democrats and Republicans are saying, well, this had to do with the pandemic. This was about new voting technology. What did you find, or what have you found so far, that really led to these discrepancies, Tia?
Well, as you can imagine, the AJC's really been on top of these issues for months, you know, and a lot of these things are worst case scenarios that counties, the state, and, you know, voting rights groups had predicted. That being said, there are no answers right now. There are a myriad of factors that are being considered, and there are investigations underway, but there are no clear answers of exactly, you know, one thing that caused the breakdown. There are probably many. For example, you mentioned the new voting machines. And because of the pandemic, the training was not allowed to be carried out in person. Training was limited. Because of the pandemic, there were a lot of new workers. You know, your average poll worker is a lot of times elderly people who've been doing it for ages. Well, those folks are at high risk and didn't feel comfortable staffing the election. And so there were not a lot of new poll workers, even as recently as just the weekend prior to the election. Fulton County was looking for volunteers at the polls. So the lack of information, the lack of training, again, the state of Georgia did try to encourage mail-in voting to cut down on the lines, but there were breakdowns even with that process. Fulton County lost requests, so people never got ballots. Fulton County took a long time to process the ballots because they were overwhelmed by demand. So they're just so many, and, you know, social distancing at the polls played a part because you had to slow down the process. So there were just a lot of factors that were likely at play.
Tia, the state of Georgia, as we mentioned at the top, has a history of voting issues, and some might argue even voter suppression. Can you tell us a little bit about that and why there may be concerns that these efforts are deliberate towards poor and Black communities in particular?
So, yes, concerns about Georgia in voting and particularly when it comes to access for African Americans has been an issue for decades. And of course, there were parts of the state that were covered under the Voting Rights Act. And some of those protections were lifted by the Supreme Court ruling. And so there's always been focus on ensuring that Georgia is held accountable for its breakdowns. But that became even more pronounced in 2018 when there was that close governor's election and Stacey Abrams, you know, raised a lot of questions about voter suppression, access to the polls, the way that absentee ballots were counted. And we know that statistically, if you're a person of color or if you're younger, your ballot is more likely to be deemed ineligible. And so,
well, T, I want to stop you right there. You said if you're a person of color or you're younger, your ballot is more likely to be deemed ineligible. Why is that? And who's making that decision?
And I want to be clear, I'm talking about mail-in absentee ballots. And those are, again, that's something that has been held true nationwide. And it's because from absentee ballots, you have to make sure the signature matches. You know, there are a lot of safeguards in place to ensure there's not fraud. And as a result, when people are ensuring the absentee ballot was filled out accurately, you know, if you're older, your signature might have changed. If you're younger, you might be a new voter who doesn't follow all the steps and misses something that gets your ballot ruled ineligible. So those are kind of the surface reasons. But again, there are voting rights groups and some folks, you know, that's something Stacey Abrams raised in 2018 is perhaps some of these technicalities were used to disenfranchise groups of voters in a way that is politically expedient for certain folks in power.
So, Tia, let's talk about that because you mentioned Stacey Abrams, but are we seeing any accountability on either side of the political divide as far as who's going to make sure that this doesn't happen in August and in November? Or is a lot of the are a lot of the efforts to make sure people can vote being really undertaken right now by voter rights groups?
So initially, you know, on election day and in the morning after, there was a lot of finger pointing. The state, which in Georgia, the state decides the equipment and the voter system for all of the counties. And so the state was saying, hey, we did our job. The counties, which are in charge of ensuring that its precincts have the right equipment, have the number of workers needed. That's where the breakdown was. And of course, the counties were saying, no, the state didn't give us enough support and the state didn't ensure that everything was needed. And then you had the outside voter rights groups we've been asking for these things and you guys weren't listening. I do feel like by yesterday evening, and even in the AJC, our follow-up articles, there seems to be a little bit moderation of the finger pointing where even at the state level and the county level, they're saying we need to work together to fix the issues because it's unacceptable. We have runoffs that will be not statewide, but certain parts of the state will have to go back to the polls for runoffs. But then again, in November, Not only is it back to statewide election, but turnout is expected to double, if not more than double, compared to Tuesday's election. So the stakes are much higher. If those same issues are to happen again, the lines will be even longer. The waits will be even longer. The possibility of disenfranchisement of voters will be even higher. So I do believe that even our General Assembly is coming back into session after, you know, a hiatus because of the coronavirus. And there may even be some movement when they return to start addressing these issues and coming up with solutions, knowing that they don't want to repeat in November.
Tia, before I let you go, I've got to ask you what you're hearing from the voters themselves, particularly those who've had to wait on these egregiously long lines. And as you mentioned, social distancing, wearing masks, you know, being outside for that many hours. Are the voters that could stand to be disenfranchised if things aren't fixed by August or by November, are they determined to stand and return? Are they determined to cast a ballot? Or are you sensing that these mix-ups could really lead to people ending up staying home?
That's very interesting you raised that point. The sense we got from voters on Tuesday, particularly in Metro Atlanta, is that they were resolute. And they also were supported by organizations that brought water and snacks. Even some places had a DJ for music, and folks were making friends in line and sharing chairs, and people volunteered to be quote unquote line warmers, to stand in line for folks to allow them to, you know, maybe go sit in their car for a little bit and rest their legs. So people, especially in this climate, you know, voting on Tuesday happened still as there have been protests and discussion about so many issues. And folks realize that elections do matter, because who you put in power can have a lot of say over whether some of these policies when it comes to policing and funding for public services changes. So people are saying, yes, we want it fixed, but they were, of course, we lost some voters on Tuesday, but there were a lot of voters who stuck it out for hours because they believed it's important.
We'll see what happens in August and, of course, in November. Tia Mitchell is the Washington correspondent with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Tia, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And while the world's eyes have been turned to the uprising against racism and police violence, some parts of the country are seeing new upticks in coronavirus cases and deaths. COVID-19 cases are increasing in nearly two dozen states, and hospitalizations related to the virus are on the rise in at least nine. In Arizona, for example, hospitals have been told to activate coronavirus emergency plans, and Texas has seen a 42% increase in coronavirus hospitalizations since Memorial Day. Here to help us understand the latest on the pandemic is Dan Diamond, a reporter at Politico who investigates healthcare politics and policy with a special focus on the Trump administration and the COVID-19 outbreak. Dan, welcome to the show.
Tanzina, thanks so much for having me.
Is there a trend in where we are seeing coronavirus upticks here? Are there certain geographic regions, or is this sort of haphazard all over the country?
Well, there is a trend in that the upticks are where they were not before. If the early days of the coronavirus outbreak in the United States were concentrated on the coast and urban centers like New York City or Seattle, now we're seeing hotspots all around the country, and particularly in the middle of the country, states like Arkansas, Utah, Arizona. These are states that have not had as much rapid spread, but now there are indications that factories, plants, or some states that may have opened up rather quickly are facilitating spread and transmission of the virus. And that makes it a lot harder to get a handle on exactly where the next hotspot is, to try and tamp down before there is significant more spread.
Of course, the way coronavirus has been handled so far has pretty much been state by state. There are federal recommendations from the CDC, but each state is handling its openings and reopenings as it sees fit. So, Dan, do we know what's causing these spikes? And I know there's a lot of controversy around this. Is some of it because of the fallout from Memorial Day, perhaps where there were lots of gatherings? Is some of this related to the protests that we're seeing around the country?
It depends on which state you're looking at, Tanzina. And also, there's a major fight over trying to decide who is to blame for these spikes. I'm seeing it emerge right now as a political reporter. Republicans and Democrats and Congress and beyond, and then the White House certainly, are trying to assign blame to the other party for why there is a recent spike. But I think if you delve into the numbers, it's very specific based on local factors. So Utah is a clear case study of why the virus is going up in that state. Hundreds of workers at a meatpacking plant in Utah, the meatpacking plants that have been ordered to stay open, hundreds of workers at this one plant have tested positive and are now responsible for about a third of the state's total cases. Now, it's not just them. The former governor, John Huntsman Jr., who's running for governor again, also has tested positive recently. But it's clear that that is the hotspot driving so much of what's happening in Utah. Meanwhile, in a state like Texas, which moved to reopen very quickly a few weeks ago, hospitalizations are up dramatically, and it's not as clear if there's a single driver from having reopened so quickly, people being back to work, or other factors as well. You also asked about the protests. We are a little bit early on the curve before we would start to see that manifest as an impact in hospitals. It usually takes some days before people even notice that they might have COVID-19 symptoms, and before it leads to hospitalization, there might be several weeks of seeking care. And it just takes 2 to 3 weeks, really, for the impact of something like a mass protest to really manifest in hospital numbers.
I want to talk a little bit about what you mentioned, which is the political divide here in terms of who's pointing fingers at who, Democrats versus Republicans, because there are two emerging sources of blame that I think Americans are starting to point to. There are those who say, oh, this is because of the protests. And there are those who say this is because states opened too quickly and people are sort of flinging off their masks and, you know, having barbecues with each other. Is that the root of the sort of finger pointing that the Democrats and the Republicans are doing to each other, or are there other reasons for them to do that right now?
Well, I think those are the two major themes, and it's disheartening as a health reporter to see a pandemic be politicized, especially this early in the pandemic. We are only a few months into what may be with us for a long time, and the more that the country is divided and looking for reasons for blame, the harder it's going to be to unify everyone in what could be another wave of needing to social distance. But I think both of those situations, Tanzina, get to the core issue. The only way we know how to stop COVID-19 right now is by staying apart. And the more that we are together, the more likely it is that the virus will spread. It spreads through respiratory droplets, when people are talking, coughing, when they're singing. And it doesn't matter if you're singing in a church or if you're singing in a protest near each other and maybe not everyone is wearing a mask. The closer you are to people, and particularly people who might not know that they have COVID-19 but are spreading it anyway, the more likely it's going to be that the virus will get a foothold. And the protests are more recent than the states that reopened. So if there is going to be a balance of evidence, it's probably the states that open back up rather than the more recent protests. But both of those are issues that we're watching closely, and it has muddled the way for scientists and researchers. When you have this many people either going back to work or taking to the streets, it's a lot harder to do that kind of contact tracing that I mentioned with Utah and its factory, because there could be so many different factors for why someone got sick.
Dan, we've got about a minute left, but I have to mention the federal guidance and the World Health Organization guidance around this, which has been confusing so far. Anything stand out to you there? Should we continue to wear masks? Should we continue touching surfaces or not?
I think the more masks we wear, the safer we probably will be. There's a lot of evidence that it prevents transmission to a significant percentage. The touching of surfaces, the CDC has gone back and forth. More recently, the CDC has said that if you touch a surface that someone who's infected with COVID also touched, it's probably not going to be the biggest driver in transmission. But the big takeaway to me, Tanzina, is the more we can do to keep clean, protect ourselves, wash our hands, it doesn't matter if COVID's going on or not. Those are good practices all the time.
Dan Diamond is a healthcare reporter at Politico. Dan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you?
Last night, A&E canceled their extremely popular police-based reality show, Live PD. In a statement, the network referenced the, quote, critical time in our nation's history as a reason for the move, a presumptive nod to the protests against police brutality that have gripped the nation for the past 2 weeks. A&E's decision to cancel Live PD comes days after the Paramount Network canceled its popular reality police show Cops after a 30-year run. And while it's still unclear whether the nationwide protest influenced Paramount to cancel Cops, for years, both shows have been criticized for disproportionately featuring poor people and people of color as criminals and glorifying aggressive police conduct. Joining me now to talk about all this is Dan Taberski, the host of the Running From Cops podcast, an investigative series into the show and its impact on the country. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Hey, good to be here.
So big news, right before we were going to do this segment, A&E canceled Live PD. Were you surprised?
Yeah. Honestly, I was shocked. Cops has been on for years and years and years, but in the past few years, Live PD has exponentially eclipsed it in terms of popularity. And you have to remember that it's not just that they canceled this one show, Live PD. A&E is built around this show. The last time I counted, and you have to count a lot because it changes all the time, there were 6 spinoffs of Live PD on A&E alone. And so it is just a huge moneymaker for them. And so I knew the bar was going to be higher for them to give it a rethink. But it happened, and I'm really happy.
So I want to talk about that because we'll just get right into it. I mean, you mentioned A&E has about 6 spinoffs of this, and I want to go even further and say a lot of basic cable really focuses on this sort of industry of incarceration and criminality. I mean, I'm thinking the reality shows Life After Lockup. I'm thinking Before mm-hmm. People Get Locked Up, Live PD, The First 48, 60 Days In. Like, all of these are shows that really focus on policing, criminality, and incarceration. How has this become such an important and big genre for basic cable?
Well, it's cheap. That counts. For basic cable, you can make a lot of them with a little bit of money. It's visceral. Cops was designed from the very beginning to scare the crap out of people.
To scare the crap out of who?
Out of viewers. Viewers like to be scared. It's funny. I interviewed the one of the creators of Cops, and they were talking about how when they were making it, it was almost like making a horror movie, and that you just want to make it as scary as possible, and that's part of the thrill of watching it. And it created the idea over the past few decades that the only thing standing between you, the viewer, and all that chaos that they're portraying on the show is the thin blue line. And so, it serves the police because it bolsters their image. It serves the networks because it gives them easy ratings, and it doesn't serve the people who are on the show.
Well, let's talk about that, because I wonder how much input the police had on the show in terms of was this meant to glorify policing?
One of the things we found out, and I had an inkling before we started, but I didn't realize how pervasive it was, with the show Cops, ever since the first season, the police departments that participate, and it's been over 150 police departments across the country, the police departments that participate have contractual Final Cut. So in the contracts they sign with the production company, it says that they can remove anything they want to from the show if they deem it something that they don't want it in there. So already the police are contractually, legally controlling the message, which is, I think it's shocking to most viewers that catch it once they find that out. And once you find that out, it explains a lot. In the very beginning, Cops, it started in 1989, right when the war on drugs was picking up. And it really, truly helped sell the war on drugs to the American people. The war on drugs was really violent. And it sort of said that we need police to use these really violent tactics to tamp down on drug use. And it was flashy. And it helped sell that method of policing to people as something that was necessary.
The quote-unquote war on drugs from the 90s was something that also disproportionately affected Black and brown Americans, mm-hmm. poor Americans, inner city folk, yep. to use that term. In your analysis of Cops over the years, was there a disparity in the frequency that showed people of color being arrested as opposed to white people? Because to me, what I always took away from Cops was it always focused on poor people for the majority.
Yeah, so in the very beginning, the NAACP called up cops in the first season, and they said, you guys are showing all your criminals as black and brown people. And the show Cops actually changed because of that, but they changed in a really creepy way, and that they just decided to focus on poor white communities, right? And so it always focuses on poor and working class people. And so that's the sort of texture you get after seeing Cops for the past 30 years, is that you do see a lot of poor white people being arrested. Overall, the numbers of black and brown people being arrested and white people being arrested are about the same as FBI data shows. And that's not acknowledging at all the potential and probable discrepancies with the way police actually decide to arrest these people, but it matches the FBI data. What we did find in our data, and we watched 847 episodes of the show and did a really detailed data analysis, is that Cops front loads crime by people of color. So basically, if 48% of people of color committing violent crime on the show Cops, it's shown in the first 7 minutes of the show. And it's very similar with drug crime. It's just about 50%. Whereas for white people committing those same crimes, they only front load about 24%. And so what that says, as somebody who's been a television producer, and I've made reality shows, not quite like Cops, but similar things. You know that if you're making a television show, you need to put the most catchy stuff up front. You need to hook your viewers in. And so it begs the question, why did the producers of that show for the past 30 years, consciously or unconsciously, think that crime by people of color was what people wanted to see?
And I'm going to ask you to sort of take that further and interpret perhaps the effect that that's had on the American public. I mean, this is a show that we all know. We all know the theme song for it. This is something that's been around for 30 some odd seasons. So what effect has that had on the way that Americans view policing, criminality, and the people who are caught up in this?
I mean, it's a combination of things. It changes the way that Americans look at who is committing crime. It also changes the way that Americans look at the efficacy of policing. On the show Cops, 99% of chase scenes on the show Cops end in arrest. That is nowhere near the reality in real life. And so it creates this illusion that, oh, if something happens, the police should chase them because they're going to get them. But that's just not what happens. It also creates an image of a world that's much more violent than is in reality. 3 times the amount of violent crime on Cops, 4 times the amount of drug crime, 10 times the amount of prostitution. And so it just creates this world that really bolsters the need for not just policing, but a certain type of policing that that, as we know, disproportionately impacts communities of color.
Dan, I want to ask you about something that happened recently with Live PD. They were under scrutiny and receiving a lot of criticism for a violent arrest that the producers on that show witnessed. What can you tell us about that?
I mean, you know as much as I do, Live PD hasn't been super transparent about that. I mean, there was a case in Williamson County where a person drove by, they didn't, Williamson County, Texas, a person drove by with headlights that weren't dimmed. And there was a camera in the car from Live PD. And so the police decided to chase the person, tase the person, and ultimately kill the person. And then Live PD deleted the footage, which just seems so egregious. And it has to be part of the reason why the show was canceled. It just shows how skewed the priorities are of a show like that when you try to turn policing into entertainment. And it makes you ask the question, when you put a camera in the car with a police officer, what is he focusing on? Is he focusing on good policing or is he focusing on good entertainment? And those are two very different things.
We did reach out to Paramount to see if the protests that are happening around the country may have spurred their decision to cancel Cops in its 33rd season right now. Do you have any insight into that, Dan? We haven't heard back from them yet.
No, I don't have any insight into what went into that decision, but that's what happened. It's been on the air for so long, and it's one of those things, especially a show like Cops, like people aren't paying attention to it. It's like wallpaper, right? It's on 15, sometimes 20 times a day because it's on syndication and on cable. But it's not prestige television. So people aren't writing, critics aren't writing about it. Like, it's not something that sort of bubbles up as something that needs to be talked about culturally. It's just this sort of message that lies in the background. It gets ratings, it makes them money, and the people who are into the show watch it, and it continues to confirm that message. And I think when a moment like this happens, which is exciting and thrilling, I think it's just the kind of thing, like, the very least you can do is decide that, you know what, let's stop it with the entertainment cameras in police department cars. That is just the most obvious first step.
Police around the country right now have cameras of their own. Many of them are wearing body cameras when they're handling their arrests and interactions with the public. I'm noticing an uptick in news, in nightly news, for example, local news, using a lot of police body cam footage. Are you seeing that? Is that a way to sort of continue this bird's eye view into how police, you know, engage, if you will, or arrest people through their own body cameras versus a production?
Well, interestingly enough, one of the things that irked me the most about Live PD is that one of their spinoffs was called Live PD PD Cam. And basically all it was repurposed body cam footage from police. And so they would go and they would canvass the country and they would get body cam footage that they could get from police departments, that body cam footage that was ostensibly meant for transparency to begin with, right? That was the whole point. But they would use it for entertainment. They would take the flashiest ones and they would make entertainment shows and make millions of dollars off this material that was meant for transparency in the first place. It certainly seems like you're just seeing such a different perspective on what people are experiencing when they're policed, as opposed to what entertainment shows want you to see when they're working with police departments filming the police. And the fact that people have cameras on their phones just makes it possible.
Dan Taberski is the host of the Running From Cops podcast, an investigative series into the show Cops. Dan, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, you kidding? Thank you.
And that's it for us today. But before we go, I want to give a quick shout out to the team that works so hard to make this show every week. Our board operators, Claire McKean and Debbie Daughtry, were in the studio at WNYC for us, alongside director Vince Fairchild, with remote assistance from director and editor Jay Cowett. Alexandra Botee is our senior producer. Our producers are Jackie Martin, Ethan Oberman, Jose Olivares, Meg Dalton, Jason Tureski, and Lydia McMullen-Laird. Polly Irungu is our digital editor, Katarina Barton is our intern, and David Gable is our administrative assistant. Lee Hill is our executive producer. And of course, call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.